Accession number 30419, reel 12.
So it's very much recent memory.
It's recent memory. It was a huge RAF base, Changi. I should mention that Tengah in the west was the fighter and bomber base, and they had Hunters and Canberras and later on Javelins. Salita, which was in the middle, was for the short takeoff and landing airplanes. The Beverleys and the Pioneers were based there, transports, and the helicopters. It had no, I think it just had the one runway. Changi was the big base. The runway was being extended. It was already a mile. It was being extended to a mile and a half. And it had the Shackletons, maritime patrols. It had the Hastings, number 48 squadron. And it had the New Zealanders, number 41 squadron, which had Bristol freighters, transports. And we came in to make up the transport squadron. And it also had a target towing flight, which flew Meteors. And it was a very, very busy base. And it was also the main base for the, once the runway was extended, for the Comets and the Britannias of Transport Command. We landed at Paya Lebar, which was the civil airport, which wasn't very far away, and the runway pointed in the right direction. And there were quite a lot of instances of people landing at the wrong airport. Wanted to be in Changi and found themselves in Paya Lebar and vice versa.
I'm just going to stop you there.
So, we arrive at RAF Changi, and on 215 Squadron with me from Cranwell were Mike Cross and... Oh, heavens, I've forgotten the name of the other guy, so I shouldn't have said this. There were two or three of us who had gone from Cranwell through Oakington, through Thorny Island, onto the squadron.
You can come back if you remember the name.
I'll come back if I remember, but I remember Mike Cross as being one of them. And we had very little. We'd done two-thirds of the varsity training. We had completed the Argosy OCU, but only just. I mean, it was pared down to get us out there. And we were now going into battle. Into battle on our lumbering old unarmed transports. I was nervous. Let's say I was nervous. Changi was a lovely place to arrive, notwithstanding. It was jacaranda trees, hibiscus, all the tropical stuff. It was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Trees in flower everywhere. Changi Village, which was a sort of an attap-built wood bamboo with corrugated iron roofs, a sort of picturesque tourist village. It wasn't a tourist village, it was a native village, but the tourists now flock there. Shops selling everything, Chinese food, Indian food, Malay food, wonderful. And the population was a mix on Singapore of mostly Malays, a lot of Chinese and some Indians. So you had all the religions, you had the festivals, Taipu Sam, Hari Raya, the lot. It was magic land. I remember there was an officers' club where you could go, and there was a swimming pool, and they showed films on a Saturday night on a sheet by the pool. And remember seeing South Pacific. I don't know whether you've ever seen South Pacific, a romanticized view of the South Pacific. But we were in the South Pacific. It was like that for us. And I met a girl. There was a little WAF officer on the base. Lovely girl, and she was 2 years younger than I was, and I fell in love with her, and she was attracted to me, and we started going out together. It was romantic. We had all the beer we could drink, lovely bar in the officers' mess. Temple Hill officers' mess was built in the real colonial style. It was a colonial style. It was built as an artillery officers' mess before the war. Porticos and columns and verandas and punker wallers. Well, there weren't punker wallers. They were, I don't think there were punker wallers, but there was, there were motorised punkers fanning the air. Curry lunches on a Sunday. We lived in huts down around the hill, basher huts. Concrete they were, but they had atap wooden roofs and monkeys running around. There was swimming at the officers' club. We went to beach parties. We took boats out to the islands. We went downtown. We lived like kings. We ate magnificent Chinese meals for tuppence halfpenny a throw. I had bought an old Riley, 1.5 litre, which may have attracted the girl in the first place. And we went for tours up country. Went to Kuala Lumpur, drove to Kuala Lumpur, through countryside which 6 years before had been off limits because of the terrorists. Rubber plantations, secondary jungle, pineapple. I thought pineapples grew on trees, Kathy. They don't. They grow on the ground in fields in Malaya.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Bullock carts lumbering along these roads. Chain ferries where you went across swollen streams on with puttering old diesel engines. Dancing in nightclubs in Kuala Lumpur. I remember Peter O'Toole was in one. They were making Lucky Jim. Lord Jim. And there was, I was dancing alongside Peter O'Toole and having a whale of a time. And we went to the cinema in Singapore. Singapore itself was fairyland, with Collyer Quay and the sampans going in and out for the freighters. Huge amount of shipping in the straits there. The smells, it reeked to high heaven. It was wonderful. It smelled of everything. Singapore River was jam-packed with sampans on which the Chinese lived. And so it was really an open sewer, but we were eating right alongside it. None of us, as far as I was aware, was ever ill. We never had any stomach problems in Singapore. The food was wonderful. We would go out at night to Bido Corner, which was lit by fairy lights, kerosene lamps, actually. And we had fresh Chinese food from the wok and tiger beer. We drank gallons and gallons of tiger beer. It was just tremendous. I was 23 years old, in love, and the world was absolutely bloody wonderful. And then came the flying. I mean, that life went on for 2.5 years. The romance didn't last 2.5 years, but there were other girls.
That was the background, yeah.
And it was always like that. When we got back to base in Changi, we had, I think, one of the most wonderful environments for an RAF base to be in that there can ever have been.
Can you tell me about the base itself? Where were you actually living?
Yes.
What were the quarters like?
Yes. I just haven't been able to find out how big the base was, but it was the biggest station in the RAF. It had there was a barracks on it where the one stage the Seaforth Highlanders were. I remember that because I had trouble with some of them when I was orderly officer. There were these squadrons, and I've forgotten how many, because every transport aeroplane had a crew of five, say, and so there must have been 50 aircrew in our squadron, because we had 10 crews. There were 8 Shackletons, so that must have been another, and they had many more on their crew, so I've lost count of the number of people that were there. I've got the statistics somewhere. And a lot of them had their families there. There were dozens of schools. literally dozens of schools. There were the primary schools, junior schools, secondary schools, and grammar school. Not grammar schools. There wouldn't have been grammar schools, I don't think. When it came to grammar school, the children had to go back to England. But there were certainly secondary schools. And there were teachers, expatriate British teachers there. And some of them had their families. So there were huge communities living out there. There were all the ground crew, of course. There were many more ground crew on the squadron than there were air crew. And they had a sergeant's mess and another ranks mess. They had the NAFI club. They had the chalet club, which was a big social club for all the families. On the station was the headquarters of Far East Air Force. And they had their own officers' mess and their own airmen's mess and their own sergeant's mess. It was huge. There was a hospital. And the Changi Hospital was the key hospital in the Far East for the forces. They had nurses, they had doctors, there were dentists, there were everything you could possibly think of, all expatriates. Enormous infrastructure. And there were banks. There was a branch of the Chartered Bank in the village. There was a taxi firm run by a very entrepreneurial Chinese. So you went everywhere by taxi, and the cost of peanuts. Of course, some of us insisted on having our own cars. It would have been far more economical to use taxis everywhere. And there were buses that took you everywhere. There were buses into town. It was an extraordinary environment. And some of the RAF people who were on our crews never left camp. I remember there was one quartermaster, young guy, younger than I was, who just wanted to spend his 3 years, because we were all on three-year accompanied tours where you were married, and he just wanted to spend his 3 years saving up to buy a sports car when he got home. That was his ambition. Fair enough, he could do it. We had all the sports. I played cricket, hockey, darts, rugby, water skiing, did all those. I was the cricket captain on the squadron, and used to. It was enormous fun. The rugby was extraordinary. It rained a lot. It rained a lot, but it drained away very quickly too, because it was this very loose jungle earth with. The kind of grass that grows in the tropics, not like on our lawns here. But the rugby could be played in all weathers. There were some pretty desperate times, though, in real torrential downpours, and sometimes the lightning stopped play. The weather was always you're always aware of the weather. The monsoon, as I say, changes direction once a year, twice a year. And there is a dry period. I can remember in what would be the British autumn, there was a dry period when water was rationed. But then when the monsoon broke, which would be around about December time, by golly, it broke. Sorts of water you just can't imagine, except if you've been living in Herefordshire in July. It was that sort of rain, but every day. Big monsoon rains to take it away, you got wet, and it was so heavy that you couldn't keep dry if you were walking, because it bounced up off the pavement right up to your head. So you had an umbrella, but it was useless. There were storms called the Sumatras, which used to drift across from over the straits from Sumatra, which was Indonesia. And these were the big guys. These were massive storms, and they could go on for a day and a half. And they never stopped us flying, but it made the flying extremely adventurous, shall we say. And when the Sumatra came, there were enormous winds with it as well. The winds could gust up to 60 miles an hour in those Sumatras. And so this meant that many a beach party turned into it didn't matter. If you got wet, you got wet, because you dried out again. Although, strange enough, because you got used to the heat, you could get quite shivery in the middle of a Sumatra downpour.
Because you were just used to constant heat.
That's right. And everything was damp. Everything rotted that could possibly rot. You put your... if you stored your RAF blue uniforms in your locker in your room, they just fall apart. They all had to stay at home in England. If you had anything that was brought out from England, it would rot away. You had to wear very lightweight, mostly with some polyester in them, clothing, very lightweight cotton stuff.
Yeah, can you talk me through what your kit was over there?
The kit? Well, you went out with the standard RAF issued khaki drill, and the first thing you did was the first evening that you were in Singapore, in Changi, you went down to the Chinese tailor, and he measured you up for your Singapore issue kit. Had to buy it yourself, cost about half a crown, you know. And they made it overnight, so the next day you went and picked it up. Very swish. Two pairs of khaki shorts. The shorter the the better. One squadron leader was persuaded by John Horsfall to have his shorts even shorter than that. And when he put on his bush jacket, because that was the other thing you got a bush jacket, very stylish, looking, you felt like Errol Flynn in Snows of Kilimanjaro. That came down over his shorts, and he got sent off parade for forgetting to put his shorts on. True story. And you got khaki short sleeve shirts. The only thing that had long sleeves was the bush jacket. And did it have long sleeves? No, I think that had short sleeves as well. Officer Patton cap, of course. Khaki socks and black shoes. Although there did come in a fashion for wearing desert boots, suede boots, which I took to very readily. And that was okay when we were jungle flying.
Why was that?
When you were out in the jungle. Well, they were much more appropriate for the conditions you were in than black leather shoes. So that was the kit that you wore. And you got it from the Chinese tailor. And when it wore out, you just got some more from the Chinese tailor. They were marvellous. And that you also got your civilian clothes made there, a pair of slacks, shirts. Oh, the other thing he made was your mess kit. White shark skin jacket mess kit. We really thought we were the bee's knees. White shirts, blue trousers, I suppose. And that was very smart. For flying, we had khaki lightweight flying suits. And not much else. Pair of underpants and that's all you put on, because when you were at low level, it was so extraordinarily hot. Socks, of course, stop your feet sweating. Well, my first captain was the flight commander, Squadron Leader Leary, and he always wore black shoes everywhere he went. I remember that particularly because I used to follow them up the ladder to the flight deck. So that's what we wore. The women had to wear... There were strict rules for dress in the mess after 6 o'clock. And the women had to wear skirts and petticoats. They weren't allowed to be seen without a petticoat, extraordinary, and long sleeves, and of course no low-cut dresses. And that was what we wore. I think most of the airmen continued in their RAF standard khaki drill. It seemed to be the officers who affected these rather swish efforts from the Chinese tailor. But the airmen were much more down to earth, and I think they had a very strong community amongst themselves. With us, there was a gap between the married people and the non-married people. The non-married people lived in the mess, and the married people lived in hirings and quarters. And we didn't see each other except at the squadron on duty, and maybe the Saturday night film at the officers' club. The airmen had far more social gathering in their clubs, I think. Right. So it was a social life.
I was going to say, can you tell me, just give me an idea of how the squadron was set up?
Yes.
And the sort of the hierarchy within the squadron.
Yes. Each squadron had its own headquarters, so you were self-sufficient in your own headquarters and your support structure. There was a station operations where you would go for briefings and to log your flight plans not much else. I mean, that's what it was there for, and they would be in control. But the squadron was very much an autonomous unit, done purposely to breed morale and spirit purposes, I suppose. Squadron commander, ours was a wing commander, Talbot Williams. He seemed very old to me, but I've worked out that he was 35 when I was 23, so...
Not very old.
he's 80 next year. And he's a great guy. He had an MA, Wing Commander Talbot Williams, MA. Don't miss the MA. Good for him, he got an MA. So he'd come in, he was a very... he was well-tutored gentleman. Some found him pompous. I thought he was a great guy. He was very good to me, especially when my mother died. And he had underneath him, he had two or three flight commanders. So he had two flying flight commanders. They were squadron leaders. Hill Turner was one of them. But very soon he was replaced from the ranks of the flight lieutenants by John Hare. And John Leary was the other flight commander, and he was my captain when I first arrived there. Saved my life, he did, several times. Then there was an adjutant who was a warrant officer who ran all the secretarial and admin of the squadron, an engineering officer who was a flight lieutenant, and he had he ran the ground crew. But one of the flight commanders had responsibility for the welfare of the ground crew, and another flight commander had responsibility for the training aspects. So there was a matrix management as well as the line management. And then there were the crews, and there were about 14 crews, which meant 14 captains, 14 co-pilots, 14 navs, and 14 flight engineers. The flight engineers were a law unto themselves. A lot of them were warrant officers who had been in the war. Mine was. Warrant Officer Howarth was our engineer, and he was great, absolutely great, calm and...
Very experienced.
Very experienced. Then there were there was a pilot leader. So there was a guy called Jerry Garforth, who came from up north, and he was the responsible for professional standards and the checking captain. There was a navigation leader, same responsibilities. There was an engineer leader, and he was actually a commissioned officer, I remember now, Hollingsworth. And there was a quartermaster leader, Warrant Officer Paddy Kane, who was about as high as that television set over there, and from Northern Ireland, and ruled them with a rod of iron. Fantastic little guy he was, and extraordinary experience as well. And then there were the various trades in the ground crew. There were seven trades: electronic fitters, engineering, radio, instruments, airframe. I can't remember the other two, Kathy, but there were about seven trades. And so they were in vertical groups, as it were, and they were ran on rosters. They had rosters, which, because they looked after the first line servicing of the airplanes, which meant that they had to be available day and night, because we flew day and night. That's about it. I think that there was a crew room in the squadron building. There was office for the flight commanders, obviously the wing commander, commanding officer, had his office, and the adjutant next to him. The flight commanders had their own offices. So it was a double story building, and along one side at the top were the offices, and down below were the servicing areas. At the big room at the bottom was the operations room, which was covered in plastic wall charts with Chinagraph pencil rosters and readiness states and missions dates and all the rest of it. There was a locker room where you kept your kit. There was a canteen run by some enterprising Indians who sold us egg banjos, which were probably the most cholesterol friendly, if you see what I mean, fried egg and bacon butties. They were terrific. We used to have those for breakfast, or mostly at 11 o'clock in the morning, I suppose. And then above the operations room was the crew room, which was where the crews were when they weren't flying. And there was a lot of card playing went on in that crew room, and chai-iking and people studying or reading papers or reading books or mugging up on their pilot's notes or whatever they felt like doing. That was the crew room. That's how I remember it. And we used to fly from there. So outside the headquarters was the dispersal, which was on the eastern end of the old runway that had been built by the prisoners of war. On the other side of the runway was the dispersal for the Shackletons and the New Zealanders. We had 10 Arguses, if they were all serviceable, parked in echelon along the runway. And they had to be in echelon because there wasn't room to get them any other way, and also you had to turn. You had to have them so that you could turn to take them out or bring them in. And we started to fly. The induction to the squadron, I don't remember that there was too much to it apart from going and flying. You had a secondary duty, that was the other thing. Everybody had to have a secondary duty. And mine was a entertainments member at the mess. I had to organise the films on a Saturday night, which took me down to the NAFI, to the girls in the NAFI headquarters in town, to pick up the films.
That sounds like rather a good secondary duty.
It wasn't an arduous secondary duty, no. Kathy, that's quite right. And I was captain of cricket, that was another secondary duty.
Another not very arduous
secondary duty. Not very arduous.
I'll just stop it for the next reel.